Hello again, and welcome to week 7 of our 8-week movie series. Once again, I just begin by reminding you to turn off your cell phones and pagers and whatnot. Since last week, I received an email request from two members of the audience to make the discussions a bit easier to follow by defining romance and love. It's a request which I have a lot of sympathy with, but which I hardly know how to comply with, since really the point of the discussions over the past 6 Tuesdays have been for us to see how the definitions of both terms have changed over the years and as the culture has changed. And never has that change been more pronounced than it was in the 17 years between last week's film, The Apartment, and this week's, which is Woody Allen's Annie Hall, winner of the Best Picture Oscar, incredible as that seemed, now in 1977. One of the significant moments in the latter film comes when the title character, played by Diane Keaton, asks her lover, Alvy Singer, played by Woody Allen himself, if he loves her. Love is too weak a word for what I feel, he replies. I lurve you, you know, I loathe you, I luff you, two F's. Yes, I have to reinvent. Of course I do. Don't you think I do? The whole film is about this reinvention of the very idea of love to fit with the changed cultural landscape in the post-revolutionary 1960s. And yet, I do think that one constant in the definition of romance, and something that sort of survives even the rocky cultural transition of the 60s, is the idea of fatedness. That is, even after the sexual revolution, we still have an attachment, albeit a wistful and nostalgic one, to the idea of there being just one right person in the world for us. The notion survives in Annie Hall in the song the title character sings for her audition on the night when the love affair with Alvy Singer is consummated. This is It Had to Be You by Gus Kahn, lyrics and Isham Jones, music. A song that also figures prominently in next week's film, When Harry Met Sally. The chorus, which is all we hear of it in this movie, and not all of that, goes like this. It had to be you.
Sing it.
Well, I would, but I don't want to show off. It had to be you. It had to be you. I wandered around and finally found the somebody who could make me be true, could make me be blue, or even be glad just to be sad, thinking of you. Some others I've seen might never be mean, might never be cross or try to be boss, but they wouldn't do, for nobody else gave me the thrill. With all your faults, I love you still. It had to be you. It had to be you. It had to be you. Semantically, it's a perfect summing up of the romantic ideal, but in such a downbeat, slow, melancholy arrangement, and sung in Diane Keaton's thin, waif-like voice, as to be heartbreaking. The effect is magnified by the inattention of the crowd and the ambient noise in the club, which suggests the indifference of the world, and of fate itself, perhaps, to the romantic ideal she is singing about. This makes a song supposedly about romantic fulfillment point us towards the reality of romantic unfulfillment, which is the note on which the film ends. This, I guess, is how you sing when you know that it doesn't have to be you at all, that the you is always going to be optional, even though you wish as hard as you can that it weren't so. Such pessimism is, in spite of the jokes, the prevailing mood of Annie Hall. In the course of the movie, Woody Allen addresses the viewer on 3 occasions, twice to the camera at the very beginning and before we know anything else about the story, and once at the very end in voiceover, to tell jokes which he regards as significant in some way. These, quote, key jokes explain or sum up, he tells us, his view, his life, his views of life and love. The first is the one about the two women comparing notes about a Catskill resort. The first says, boy, the food at this place is really terrible. The other one replies, yeah, I know, and such small portions. This, says Woody Allen, or is it his character in the movie, Alvy Singer, is essentially how I feel about life, full of loneliness and misery and suffering and unhappiness, and it's all over much too quickly. The second joke is the one that Woody informs us intellectual fashion is often attributed to Groucho Marx, but really originates with Freud's wit in its relation to the unconscious, about how he wouldn't want to be a member of a club that would have him as a member. The third comes right at the end as a kind of summing up. This guy goes to a psychiatrist and says, "Doc, my brother's crazy. He thinks he's a chicken." And the doctor says, "Well, why don't you turn him in?" And the guy says, "I would, but I need the eggs." Again, the narrator cannot keep himself from playing the intellectual and telling us what the joke means. "Well," he says, "I guess that's pretty much now how I feel about relationships, you know. They're totally irrational and crazy and absurd, but I guess we keep going through it because most of us need the eggs." In all the movies we've seen so far in this series, there's been a strong interest in the gap between the ideal and the real. It Happened One Night places the romantic fantasy of Claudette Colbert's opposition to her father and elopement with a dashing aviator in opposition to the down-to-earth, honest Clark Gable, who represents romantic reality. The Shop Around the Corner opposes the mistaken idea that the real lovers have formed of each other in relation to the ideal they have set up in their correspondence. In The Philadelphia Story, the ideal is Tracy Lord's unrealistic expectations of marriage, and Kittredge, the man she thinks will embody them, while the real is variously presented to us by her father, her ex-husband, and her brief infatuation with James Stewart's Mike Connor. In Brief Encounter, the gap appears between the romantic dalliance the couple contemplate and the crushing and prohibitive reality of their respective marriages. In An Affair to Remember, it is between Cary Grant's image as an international playboy and his longing for true love. In every case, it's the ideal that has to take a tumble in order for romance to flourish. Or, to put it another way, reality proves to be more romantic than those exploded romantic fantasies. In The Apartment, this is also true, but only at the very last minute and somewhat ambiguously. Up until then, the romantic ideal as represented by marriage and family has shown up as a sham, while the reality of sordid, surreptitious, and loveless couplings in poor Baxter's apartment is merely squalid. One thing I should have mentioned about that movie last week, as Bill Shambra pointed out to me afterwards, was the Dionysian aspect of the scene of the Christmas party at his consolidated life. The film seemed to be going out of its way to pour scorn on the very idea of anything truly romantic emerging from these scenes of drunken excess and debauchery among lonely people in the big city, who, so far as we can see, are incapable of forming real, serious, meaningful attachments. Yet, this made the romance, when it finally did happen, if it finally did happen, all the more remarkable. The pessimism of Woody Allen's movie, as suggested by all three of his significant jokes, can be summed up in the avowed meaning of the third one about the eggs, which is that romance is now to be regarded as nothing but fantasy, but a fantasy that we can superimpose with greater or lesser success upon reality in order to console ourselves for reality's nastiness, which here comes out in yet another Christmas party, the one at the Hollywood home of Tony Lacey, played by Paul Simon. Reality can also be summed up in that new and infinitely adaptable concept, the relationship, a word which figures prominently throughout Annie Hall. There were no relationships in the movies predating the sexual revolution. There were engagements, marriages, and divorces, but no relationships. Everything was seen in relation to marriage, which is what kept those movies' romantic feet on the ground. Once relationships became a valid cultural alternative to marriage, everything became relationships, even marriage itself. Alvy has had two already. And the longing for romance is relegated to the nostalgic dream world of It Had to Be You, or Diane Keaton's other song in the movie, Seems Like Old Times. To my ear, behind all this there lurks an intellectual who is trying to show us how bright he is for seeing through the illusion of romance. Paradoxically, fantasy is all he has left because he can't believe that romantic love is real. This attitude is part of a more general posture of melancholy pessimism that sees the world as divided into the horrible and the miserable, and is grateful for being miserable because it only means that things aren't yet horrible. This is also why Alvy admits that he is incapable of enjoying life, but precisely because he is not, as Annie accuses him of being, an island unto yourself. On the contrary, I can't enjoy anything unless everybody is, he says with unintentionally comic pretentiousness. If one guy is starving someplace, that puts a crimp in my evening. This posture of a world-embracing, melancholy compassion was a popular one in the 1970s and is still widely shared among intellectuals and would-be intellectuals. Like being too bright to believe in old-fashioned love, which is why Alvie tells Annie that he needs to invent a new word for it, it's a form of showing off. And yet, Alvie, like his alter ego behind the camera, is also suspicious of intellectuals. He is both ludicrously pretentious. Another example is when, after the first time he and Annie make love, he sighs to her, as Balzac said, "There goes another novel." And at the same time, he's able to make fun of his own pretension, at least as a child, in the joke about the expanding universe. Or is that a joke? Let's give him the benefit of the doubt. The scene in which he brings Marshall McLuhan out from behind a display ad in the lobby of the movie theater to puncture the pretensions of the blowhard behind him in line is just one of several barbs at the expense of the highfalutin brainiacs he at times wants to associate himself with and at other times wants to denounce, including the not very funny jokes about mental masturbation or how intellectuals prove that you can be absolutely brilliant and have no idea of what's going on. His feelings of ambivalence towards intellectuals are a fascinating subtext of Annie Hall, and I suspect we may want to say more about them later. But perhaps a more interesting thing for us to take away from his joke-founded personal approach to his material is how me-centered Annie Hall is when compared with the other movies in our series. It's impossible to imagine Frank Capra or Ernst Lubitsch or George Cukor or David Lean or Leo McCary or Billy Wilder making a movie so much about himself and his own love life. It was widely known that Diane Keaton, Woody Allen's co-star, had been his real-life lover, and her real name was Hall. Likewise, he and his pal Tony Roberts supposedly called each other Max in real life, just as they do in the movie. Just as it is impossible to imagine such jolly, if self-indulgent, japes in the other movies, so it is equally impossible not to see Annie Hall as an autobiographical document, and its subject and author barely bothers to disguise the fact. This suggests that it's really another of the movie's jokes, which should be regarded as the key joke in his life. Hey, don't knock masturbation. It's sex with someone I love. Self-love is also what is behind the running joke about his characters and his own 15 years in psychotherapy. Psychiatrists are like intellectuals in being both admired and deferred to and ridiculed. But they retain their position on a pedestal because they validate the quest for personal happiness and fulfillment, which is really how both the lovers approach their relationship. Their romance is really with themselves, not with each other. The verse to "It Had to Be You," which Diane Keaton doesn't sing, goes like this. Why do I do just as you say? Why must I just give you your way? Why do I sigh? Why don't I try to forget? It must have been that something lovers call fate kept me saying, I have to wait. I saw them all, just couldn't fall till we met. Excuse me. It's a perfect description, not only of the traditional romance, but also of what neither one of them is willing to do, and what each of them runs to a psychoanalyst to complain about the others expecting of them. A new book by Francis Dolan called Marriage and Violence, The Early Modern Legacy, from the University of Pennsylvania Press, as reviewed by Carlin Romano in the current issue of the Chronicle of Higher Education, supposedly offers as its most provocative idea the view that marriage, by its confused nature, amounts to a form of violence against individuality, sometimes prompting other forms as well. That's certainly a view that would recommend itself to Annie Hall, although only after she's been guided by Alvie to go to a psychoanalyst, and so to learn to look at it in this way. In the famous split-screen scene, where both partners are talking separately to their analysts, she says, "Since our discussion's here, I feel I have a right to my own feelings. I think you would have been happy because I really asserted it myself," she says. That is, against Alvie. True, she tells her. Alvy is paying for her sessions with the shrink, and this makes her feel guilty if I don't go to bed with him. But if I do go to bed with him, it's like I'm going against my own feelings. I just can't win. There's also something unintentionally comical about these iatrogenic feelings of inner conflict between the claims of what seems to be almost a third-party self, an entity within her which has to be conciliated and placated just as much as, if not more than, the boyfriend does. And yet, from the point of view of the self-absorbed Alvy, it must have a tragic cast. He has been her Pygmalion, made her into his fantasy lover by guiding her to be more like himself. Through undergoing psychoanalysis and taking adult education courses, and all only to see the influence of these things take her away from him. First, through the affair with her adult ed teacher, David, and then through the self-assertion she's learned from the shrink. Finally, she goes off with Tony Lacey, who has been attracted to her by her singing, which Alvy also has encouraged her to keep up. In spite of a late, half-hearted, and instantly rejected proposal of marriage, the idea that the relationship might be defined not by a mutual, ongoing self-invention, but by a once-and-for-all commitment that the lovers would have to conform themselves to, never seems to occur to anyone. That is the legacy of the sexual revolution, an idea of freedom which would would have seemed at least equally foreign and bizarre before the 1960s. Up until then, it didn't seem to most people that there could be an element of constraint, let alone oppression, as the politicized language of the hippies put it, in the free choice of a single lifetime partner. On the contrary, people gladly made that choice, and every love song stressed this wish for exclusivity and permanence as much as "It Had to Be You" does. What could be oppressive about the joy of being united with the only one for me? But if you decouple love and sex, which was the first order of business in the sexual revolution, then you could privilege the formerly discreditable and unrespectable feelings of lust, yearning to breathe free, over the constraining and binding tendency of love. The trouble is that, as in the case of so many other manifestations of immaturity, people wanted it both ways. They wanted the liberation of their sexual urges to light on whom they would and when they would and as they would, but they also wanted to dignify them by the traditional language of love that in other respects had been discarded as out of date. This is the attempted reinvention of the romance as we see it in Annie Hall and and other films of the 1970s. They were doing the same kind of thing at the same time as that new breed of movie heroes, the cartoon heroes, where we ended last year's series on the American movie hero. And both the cartoon hero and the reimagined romance were attempts to salvage something from the old honor culture which had been rejected, something that would be compatible with the individualistic, egalitarian, therapeutic culture that had succeeded it. At least Woody Allen had the grace and the insight to see in the end that it couldn't be done. And now we can watch the movie. Thank you.